Picture this. It's just before dawn on the southeast coast of England. The white cliffs of Dover are somewhere out there in the dark, but you can't see them through the mist. The air smells like the sea. A little wet, a little cold, the kind of morning where every sound carries, and the only sound right now is a rotary engine coughing itself awake on a patch of grass at Dover Aerodrome. Sitting in that fragile little monoplane, the one with cloth wings and a wooden prop and an open cockpit barely bigger than a bathtub, is a woman most of the world has never heard of. She's bundled into a purple satin flying suit, wool-lined. She's got a hot water bottle tucked against her chest to keep the cold off, goggles up on her forehead, a compass strapped to her knee. Her name is Harriet Quimby, and in about an hour, she's going to make history. I'm Tail Dragger, and you're listening to Radio Hangar. This is The Hangar. Pull up a chair, folks, because today, April 16th, is the anniversary of one of the most remarkable flights ever made, a flight that almost nobody remembers. And the reason nobody remembers it is one of the saddest little ironies in the whole history of aviation. We'll get to that. But first, a quick word about today's sponsor. This show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation Challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. Every coin tells a story. And if you've ever shaken hands with an old pilot and felt that little piece of brass pass between your palms, you know exactly what I mean. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. Now, let's get back to Harriet. To understand why, what she did on April 16, 1912 mattered, you've got to understand who she was. And who she was nobody's idea of a pilot. Harriet Quimby was a journalist, a drama critic for Leslie's Illustrated Weekly, one of the big magazines in New York City. She was 37 years old, tall, striking, dark-haired. She had a sharp wit and an even sharper pen. She'd covered theater. She'd written film scenarios for D.W. Griffith over at Biograph. She was by any measure an accomplished woman of letters, in a city that was just about the center of the American cultural universe. And then in October of 1910, she went out to an air meet at Belmont Park on Long Island, and everything changed. I don't know if you've ever had that moment, where you see an airplane, really see it, and something inside you just clicks. But Harriet had that moment. She watched those fragile biplanes claw their way into the sky, and she made up her mind, right there on that grass infield, that she was going to be a pilot, not a passenger. Not a writer covering aviation, a pilot. She enrolled at the Moissant Aviation School out on Hempstead Plains, not far from where Belmont Park sat. The school was run by the brothers of a famous aviator named John Moissant, who had just been killed flying a month or so before Harriet showed up. So this wasn't a game. The dangers were right there on the table from day one. She paid her own tuition. She showed up day after day in the cold, in the wind, with the dust kicking up off that grass field. She took her training alongside another woman, Mathilde Moissant, the sister of John, and on August 1, 1911, Harriet passed her flight test. She became the first American woman to earn a pilot certificate from the Aero Club of America, certificate number 37, not the first woman in the world. That honor had gone to a French woman, Raymond de La Roche, a couple years earlier. But Harriet was the first one here in the United States, and she knew exactly what that meant. She started flying in exhibitions. She drew huge crowds. She designed her own flying suit, that purple satin getup I mentioned. Practical because it was warm and it didn't snag in the wires, but also theatrical because Harriet understood something that a lot of early aviators didn't. She understood publicity. She understood that if she was going to open doors for other women in aviation, she had to make people pay attention. And she did. Now here's where it gets interesting. In early 1912, she set her sights on a record that no woman had yet touched. The English Channel. Louis Blériot had crossed it in July of 1909 in a little 50-horsepower monoplane he'd designed himself. Since then, a handful of men had made the trip, but no woman, and Harriet wanted to be the first. She kept the whole thing secret. She didn't want another woman, a British aviatrix named Eleanor Treehawk Davies, to beat her to it. So in March of 1912, she boarded a steamer for England under an assumed name. She met with Blériot himself in France. He agreed to loan her one of his machines, a Blériot 11, the same basic airplane he'd used to cross the channel himself 3 years before. Let me tell you about that airplane, because it matters. The Blériot 11 was a single-seat monoplane wooden framework, covered in varnished linen, wingspan about 25 feet. It was powered by a Gnome rotary engine. Now for the younger pilots listening, who grew up on like Cummings and Continentals, a rotary engine is a strange beast. The whole engine spins with the propeller, the crankshaft stays still, and the cylinders rotate around it. It throws castor oil everywhere. That's why early pilots wore those long leather coats and those scarves, not for looks, to wipe the castor oil out of their eyes. The Blériot had almost no instruments, a tachometer, a fuel gauge, that's about it. No airspeed indicator worth mentioning, no altimeter you could trust, no turn coordinator, no attitude indicator, nothing. Harriet got to Dover in early April, 1912, And then she waited, because the weather on the channel in April is, well, it's the channel in April. Fog, wind, rain, low ceilings. Day after day, she'd go out to the airfield, and day after day, the weather would say, not today. Finally, on the morning of April 16th, the weather broke. Sort of. It was still foggy, still cold. The wind was light but shifty. Visibility was maybe a mile, maybe less. Her friends tried to talk her out of it. A well-known English aviator named Gustav Hummel offered to make the flight in her place, wearing her flying suit, with her goggles on, and pretend to be her when he landed. He was that worried. He figured she'd drown. Harriet said no. She said if she was going to have the record, she was going to earn it. At about 5:30 in the morning, she climbed into the Blériot, that hot water bottle tucked against her chest, the compass strapped to her knee. And here's the part that stops me cold every time I think about it. She had never flown with a compass before. The Blériot 11 she'd trained on in America didn't have one. She had taught herself how to use it on the ground the night before, reading a library book by lamplight. Think about that for a second. No instrument training, no ATIS, no flight following, no GPS. She's about to fly across 22 miles of open, frigid water in a machine made of wood and fabric and piano wire, powered by an engine that was about as reliable as a campfire in a rainstorm. In the fog, alone, with a compass she'd learned to read the night before, she taxied out onto the grass. The gnome coughed to life, spitting that castor oil mist that every pilot from that era remembered for the rest of their days. She opened the throttle, and that fragile little airplane rolled across the turf and lifted off into the mist. 2 minutes into the flight, she was in solid cloud. She climbed, looking for the top, pushed the Blériot up to about 1,500 feet, and eventually broke out into sunshine. Beautiful, golden morning sunshine. And below her, the channel was completely hidden under a sheet of white. Nothing but cloud, no horizon line underneath, no landmarks, no coastline to follow, just a compass needle on her knee and the drone of the gnome in her ears. She flew by compass for the next 20 minutes or so, just her and that needle, cold cutting through even the hot water bottle. The airplane pitching and settling in the little bumps of air over the water. At one point, she later wrote, the engine started to miss, just a little cough, and her heart stopped. Because if that gnome quit over the middle of the channel, she was done. No life vest, no rescue boat standing by, no helicopter. Just cold water and a long fall. The engine caught again. She kept flying. And then eventually she saw a break in the cloud. A gap. And below her, green, France. She had drifted south of her intended landing at Calais. Way south. She was over a beach near the little village of Hardelot, about 25 miles off course. But she was in France. She throttled back, spiraled down, and put the Blériot onto the firm sand at low tide. Slick as you please, she climbed out. Local fishermen came running across the beach. They had never seen an airplane before in their lives. A woman from the village brought her a cup of hot tea, and Harriet Quimby, American drama critic, aviatrix, became the first woman to fly across the English Channel. It should have been the story of the decade. It wasn't. Here's that sad little irony I mentioned. The Titanic had struck an iceberg on the night of April 14th. She went down in the early hours of April 15th. When Harriet landed on that French beach on the morning of April 16th, every newspaper in the English-speaking world was running 6-inch black headlines about the 1,500 souls lost in the North Atlantic. The story of a woman flying the channel got pushed to page 6. If it got reported at all, you can find the clippings in the archives, tiny little paragraphs buried under column after column of Titanic coverage. The biggest aviation story of that spring, maybe of that whole year, and it vanished into the noise of a bigger tragedy. Harriet came home. She kept flying. She did exhibitions. She wrote articles urging more women to take up aviation. She had plans, big plans, a transcontinental flight, a book, more records. She was in every sense the kind of pilot who made the sport better just by being in it. And then on July 1, 1912, less than 3 months after the channel crossing, she was flying a brand new Blériot two-seater at an aviation meet at Squantum, just outside of Boston. She had a passenger, the meet organizer, a fellow named William Willard. At about 1,000 feet, for reasons that nobody ever fully figured out, the airplane pitched forward violently. Willard was thrown out of his seat, and a moment later, so was Harriet. Neither one of them was wearing a seatbelt. Seatbelts were considered unsporting back then. Lap straps were for nervous passengers, not for real aviators. They both fell into the mudflats of Dorchester Bay. They were both killed instantly. The Blériot, with nobody in it, glided down and landed itself in the shallows with almost no damage. Harriet Quimby was 37 years old. She had been a licensed pilot for less than a year, and in that year, she had changed what people thought a woman could do. Now I think about Harriet sometimes, when I'm strapping into my own airplane. Not because what I do is anything like what she did. I've got a transponder, and an ATIS, and a moving map, and a shoulder harness and a parachute if I really need one. I've got all the safety margin in the world compared to what she had. But I think about her because she reminds me of something we forget sometimes. Every pilot, every single one of us, is standing on the shoulders of somebody who flew with less. Less technology, less knowledge, less margin. People who took off into clouds with a compass they'd just learned to read the night before. People who bet their lives on a 50-horsepower engine and a sheet of French linen. People who did it not because it was safe, but because it was possible and because somebody had to go first. Harriet Quimby went first, on April 16, 1912, 114 years ago today. And the next time you're up there on a clear morning, looking down at a shoreline, with everything working the way it's supposed to, maybe take a second and dip your wing to her. She'd like that, I think. My thanks to Henry Holden, who wrote the definitive biography of Harriet, and to the fine folks at the Cradle of Aviation Museum out on Long Island and the Smithsonian Archives, where a lot of this history lives and breathes. More stories like this one over at RadioHanger.com. This is Tail Dragger. Keep the greasy side down.